Hello, I'm Dean Meyer. I'd like to share with you some thoughts from one of the world's leading authorities on democracy and market economics, thoughts that I believe are directly relevant to today's top executives. In January of 1990, I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Charles Ed Lindbloom, Sterling Professor of Economics and Political Science at Yale University, and a highly respected author in both fields. I found his lecture to be tremendously enlightening and thought-provoking. Everything that Ed says about the social revolution in Eastern Europe, about markets and democracy, applies to organizations. In January 1990, Ed spoke in La Jolla at the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute for their International Executive Forum. I've excerpted the key passages from this speech. As he speaks, I hope you'll translate his comments into the context of an internal economy.
Most of us are celebrating these days not the turn toward the market system, but the turn toward democracy, and yet it's clear the two are tightly linked. Linked in many ways. One of them is that it looks as though democracy is coming to Eastern Europe, not simply because the people in these countries aspire to it, because they've aspired unsuccessfully to it for some time, but because the Soviet Union has signaled some way or other to the communist parties in these countries that they were hereafter on their own and could not count on tanks and military support from the Soviet Union. And why? Why did the Soviet Union undertake such an astounding alteration of policy, such a hard-to-believe yielding of its military dominance of an entire area? We can't be sure, but it looks as though they did so because they, in a sense, in the Soviet Union, had no choice. The economy could not support its earlier obligations to maintain military dominance and economic dominance in Eastern Europe. The economy is running down. It's becoming increasingly apparent to Soviet leadership that the economy was unable to maintain even internally within the boundaries of the USSR the kind of economic activity that could prevent the Soviet Union from declining into a second or third-rate economic power in the world. This meant that Soviet leadership was looking, because of the failures of central planning, which could be interpreted to be the absence of the successes of market economic organization, they're looking at a catastrophe, a disaster, and decided that something had to be done about it. And what that something is a turn not so much toward democracy in the Soviet Union, though even there the movement is gaining strength, but a turn toward markets. And in Eastern European countries, a mixed movement in the direction both of markets and toward democracy.
Ed Lindbloom is a spare, serious, distinguished-looking professor who was just about to retire from Yale when I met him. But he was also modest and personable, charming in his own way, and spoke with a kindly sort of look in his eye.
Now, how to lay a foundation for understanding the complexities of this move toward the market? Well, I am happy to say that all I have to do, really, in order to help you lay that foundation, is tell you what you already know. All I have to do is to ask you to call up, organize, and make useful what I am sure all of you already know. I think one of the great pleasures of life is to discover from time to time that we knew something that we didn't know, or put it the other way, that we really knew something that we thought we didn't know. Now, the first thing is what a market system is. As you know, but as you may not have stopped to articulate and realize, a market system is not simply a system in which people are able to go to markets and buy things they want, because they have been doing that for a long time in the Soviet Union and in China and in Cuba and in Eastern European communist countries. They all have markets for consumer goods. Also, market system is not simply one in which there is a labor market, in which people, instead of being conscripted and assigned to work, are offered jobs at wages and recruited into those jobs or wages in a market system, because the communist systems all have that. They have had that pretty much throughout the history of communism. But the key issue is not whether there are going to be any markets in the system, but something else. What we really mean by a market system is that in addition to a market for consumer goods and a labor market, markets are used to signal the producing organizations in the economy as to what they're supposed to produce. And that's what markets do not do in communist countries. So you might say there are three uses of markets. All economic systems have the first two, but only some have the third. And it's that third that becomes the distinctive characteristic of what we customarily in common idiomatic speech call market systems. In the United States and Western Europe, the direction of production is signaled by what people buy, and in the communist systems is signaled by administrative and political decisions centrally, not by what people buy. They buy things in a consumer market, but what they buy doesn't direct production. It only distributes what central authority has already decided.
With that definition, Ed goes on to discuss the power of the market approach.
What is extraordinary about markets, and it compels the attention of anyone in the world, is that of all the social institutions that mankind has ever invented or blundered into or backed into accidentally, the market system is the most extraordinarily competent, large, detailed in articulation, coordinating, organizing system that men have ever found. I mean, there is no comparison. Let me explain. That is how important that proposition is. I mean, there is no social institution in the world through which so many different activities are made coherent, coordinated, or organized. Nothing compares with it. We take so much for granted, we don't realize the staggering accomplishment that's implicit. But if you ask, how does somebody taking a sip of coffee in Stockholm get that coffee? The only way you can answer it is through a formidable task of social organization. Now, one could imagine it being done more simply. One could imagine a coffee grower growing some coffee, roasting it, making his way on foot to the seacoast, where he there builds a boat to sail to Stockholm with, and at the same time he returns back to his home turf to bring down foodstuffs appropriate to the trip, which he has himself grown. Then he builds the boat himself and he sails it to Sweden, where he then fashions out of some kind of clay, does it himself, a cup, bakes it, and now makes a cup of coffee available to a Swedish consumer. No task in social organization is all done alone. But it's, of course, preposterous, and if it could be done, the price of coffee would be higher than any Swede would pay. How does it get there? He grows the coffee. Already in growing the coffee, he's very likely using some fertilizer, and the fertilizer may have been produced through an industrial operation which has engaged thousands of people to bring that fertilizer to him. But suppose he doesn't even use fertilizer except for manure. But he's got a few steel tools, hoe at least, a knife, produced in a factory. He's already called on the services of hundreds of people who produce the knives and who produce the metal to produce the knives, the smell of the ore to produce the metal to produce the knives. So already, in let's say cutting a few coffee beans off a plant, he's already drawing on the services of hundreds of other people. And how is he going to get the coffee down to the coast? Well, he doesn't need to worry about it. There'll be a coffee broker who comes along, probably in a pickup. How did he get the pickup? He didn't make it himself. He, of course, to get the pickup, he had to call on, in effect, on the services of all the hundreds and hundreds of people who made that pickup. And they, incidentally, had to rest on the services of all the people who, again, made the glass and the rubber and the steel and the plastics. And so just to get that pickup there requires, again, the particular tasks of thousands of people. And we haven't even begun. Now notice, I'm not saying that he has to be coordinated, the coffee broker, in a general sense that everybody has goodwill toward him and everybody stays out of his way and wishes it well. I'm saying he's coordinated in the sense that he can do his job only because thousands of other people do particular, distinctive, different jobs, all of which get put together and finally show up in the pickup, which he then can buy and use to collect the coffee. Well, I'll start filling in the rest of the story. He gets the coffee. He roasts it in professional roasting mills, which again require the manufacture of the equipment, which engages thousands of people if you trace it back. And eventually, let's say the coffee beans get down to the coast, and there's a dock for loading, and the dock has been built out of steel and wood and cement. Fill in how many people were necessary to produce the lumber at that place, the steel at that place, the cement at that place, and eventually gets it on a ship. A ship. Now start to ask, how many people does it take to get a ship in that dock? Again, you see, you've got the whole production process going way back. You've got to produce steel for ships. You've got to produce a massive amount of complex electrical equipment and equipment for, let's say, diesel engines to drive the ship. And there's no end really, it becomes nearly impossible to picture all these particular jobs that have to be done in relation to each other in a highly coherent, systematic way to get this thing put together. And on it goes. You get wholesalers, retailers, insurers, rail shippers. I don't know what number to suggest by the end of this process, but I think we have to say that a Swede in Stockholm can sip a sip of coffee produced in Colombia because hundreds of thousands, and I think if you work it out, millions of people have performed tasks, each group of task doers different from each other group, and brought together not at random, but in a systematic way. Now I ask you this question. Do you know of any coordinating mechanism on Earth that could achieve and does achieve, or that you could even imagine could achieve, that intricate, minute detail of task assignment and coordination to get that sip of coffee to Stockholm from Latin America? Well, we know how it gets done. It gets done through market relations. Governments enter in that they tax. They sometimes set prices. They provide some infrastructure. But the basic coordinating mechanism is the market system.
It's easy to see that organizations face precisely the same challenge that Ed described, that is, complex social coordination. In this analogy, top management, and perhaps some staff groups, play the role of the government in the economy.
I've given you the example of the worldwide or international market system, but you can look at the market system of the United States or any other country and see the same phenomenon. It is an extraordinarily complex institutional mechanism for achieving feats of detailed, meticulous division of labor and social coordination. And now you ask yourself, anything else in the world that compares with it? Well, someone might come along and say, a government, a national government. But a national government, even the national government, has a task of coordination as large as that of China or the United States or the Soviet Union, simply never attempts so complex and detailed, so intricate a task of coordination. It coordinates this in other ways. It says don't drive too fast on the highway and achieves a certain amount of coordination, keeping some people on the right. Makes most of us pay at least some taxes. And to some extent stops the mutilation of small children and wife battering, the latter not so successfully, so that no doubt it has a pervasive coordinating effect on our behavior, in large part to keep us from injuring each other, but it certainly does not in any way ever aspire to the mammoth intricacy and breadth of coordination that is achieved through the market system.
Ed then expands on the notion of social coordination with his memorable street corner metaphor.
There are two ways, fundamental ways of coordinating, organizing, making coherent the activities relative to each other of groups of people, large or small. 10 people often need coordinating to do something that one can't do, as in small organizations, or millions need coordinating, millions to get a cup of coffee to Moscow, to Stockholm. Two ways, basically, to do it. One is very loudly applauded in the whole history of thought, going back at least to Plato. It's the dominant, nearly ubiquitous view of what social coordination is about. That is, set up a coordinator. Make coordination the task of a committee or Politburo or supermind. Plato's idea was coordination through a philosopher king. We often think of coordination as something you have to achieve by setting up a chairman, a director, a coordinator, a governing body, something of that sort. So the basic idea is centrality, making coordination somebody's responsibility so that the tasks of coordination come to his desk and he understands that's his job, that's who he is, he's a coordinator, or who they are coordinators, and that's their task, to put it all together. And the other method of coordination, let's call it mutual adjustment or multilateral interaction. Suppose you have on a very busy street corner 20 people on one side of the street waiting for the light to authorize them to cross the street, and on the other side of the street 20 people coming toward them. Now when that light changes, you're on the verge of social disorganization, because these two groups are going to hit each other, and without some feat of social coordination, several people are going to be knocked to the ground. A fight may break out. You can't tell what will happen, but the fact is, it always is coordinated. It's very rare that in that situation a fight breaks out or that people knock each other to the ground. The coordination is usually beautiful, precise, and fast. Not because there is a policeman standing over here at the side who says to each member of the group, your turn now to move, which would be one way of getting these 40 people to pass through each other. It would be cumbersome, laborious, slow, irritating. So these people advance toward each other, and by watching each other, signaling sometimes with their eyes, sometimes with bodily movements, they tell each other where they're going, and the other either decides to defer or to signal back, maybe you think so, but I'm really coming through. But it works. Now, I've heard this kind of coordination dismissed, you see, as relatively unimportant because it doesn't deal with fast-moving situations. It's only when you can take it easy that you can achieve this kind of coordination. But that's false is illustrated immediately by, let's say, a basketball game. Now, you can't play effective basketball all by yourself. You have to coordinate with other members of the team. The only way you can score is through high degree of coordination. And while the centralist can lay down some general rules to the team as to what general positions they should play and what strategy they should follow, in the actual development of the game, almost every situation is unique and calls for coordination ad hoc on the spot. The players are in constant communication with each other, either shouting or by their movements, standing ready to receive the ball, throw the ball. The coordination is so fast that you can't even imagine a centralist describing it. He can't keep up with the action. His words won't come fast enough, let alone direct the action. Well, you may think that this kind of coordination, all right, makes sense for small operations, slow and fast, but when you get into a large social organization, it breaks down. Well, let's take another example. One of the great feats of social organization coordination that womankind has achieved all over the face of the earth, so taken for granted we don't stop to think that we know it, that it is a feat of coordination, and that is within large groups composed of millions and millions of people, people have come to be coordinated in that they somehow agree or fall into the habit of using the same sounds for the same meanings so that they can talk to each other. The same symbols, written symbols in some cases. In other words, they agree that this small little sound, it, among millions of people, has an agreed meaning. Now that's marvelous social coordination. And that goes on among English-speaking people, people who speak Kwakiutl, or people who speak French. Within each of these groups have achieved this astonishing feat of social coordination. Now, who invented Kwakiutl? What centralist has administered these sounds and symbols to the French population or the English-speaking population. No, it seems to us now inconceivable that language could ever be created that way. Languages have grown up through mutual adjustment, people trying sounds out on each other and coming to fall in without really thinking about it, habits that have coordinated their use of sound and symbol. So it's quite clear then that mutual adjustment is inevitable, practical, often fast-moving, and is capable of coordinating many millions of people. Once you understand that, you'll see that that's what market systems are a special case of. Market systems achieve their coordination through mutual adjustment. What is opening up with a new interest in the market is a new appreciation that the intricacies of detailed economic coordination within a nation or within the world as a whole, maybe after all, can be better handled by mutual adjustment, blind as it sometimes seems.
If, as we are listening to Ed's lecture, we are applying these thoughts to our organizations, we might at this point be feeling rather uncomfortable. Many of us find it hard to imagine letting go of the reins of control in a market economy, trusting the fate of the firm to a process of mutual adjustment. Ed attempts to tease us out of our fear.
Well, as to your skepticism, I can't do much here. We have time to give you lots and lots of examples. View sympathetically my allegation that you've been brainwashed through the educational system, that Plato has brainwashed you, the whole tradition of political philosophy and social theory has brainwashed you, and that it's never given a fair shake, and consequently, you and I too, even, for all the self-correction I've tried to put my head through, even I find myself stumbling into the easy solution. If there's a problem, we need a coordinator. It just is only a half-truth. We need some coordination centrally and a lot of coordination through mutual adjustment.
Still thinking in terms of global economies, Ed in parallel addresses a number of issues concerning top executives. One is controlling burgeoning headcount. How much management and staff time is spent on the internal coordination of our organizations?
Nobody in a mutual adjustment coordination system has to take on the task of coordination. That is, coordination becomes a byproduct of what you and I do. There is no coordinator out on the basketball floor. Coordination happens because I'm paying attention to the relations of me to the others that are most relevant to me, but I'm not trying to tell my teammates where to go. And in the market, you see, I'm paying attention to problems around me. Shall I buy? Shall I sell? Shall I invest? And as a byproduct of these decisions, we get a coordinated result. That means then that the intellectual tasks faced by participants in the system are drastically lowered compared to a central coordinator's tasks. And the possibility that the central coordinator simply cannot grasp his task because it's so large and complex, which is a problem the Soviet leadership has really faced, is not a problem that arises in mutual coordination. And related closely to that, of course, is that you don't need much information.
Adequate information is, of course, essential to make good decisions. Another executive concern is keeping up with everything that's going on, even in one small part of the company. In cybernetic terms, we call this the issue of requisite variety.
Of course, in our world, we need mammoth amounts of information for all kinds of things, but for the particular task of economic coordination, difficult as it may seem for a businessman to assemble all the information he needs to make his decision, his informational needs are tiny compared to the informational needs of the planning bureau in the Soviet Union, which has to know really everything that each businessman needs to know, plus a lot more. So that you get a simplification of analytical task, and you get a simplification of information, a reduction of information needs.
Another executive challenge is making large, cumbersome organizations flexible and responsive to customer needs.
There's a flexible, open-ended, you might even say bouncy quality to mutual adjustment that central coordination doesn't have. Central coordinators tend to try to close issues. Mutual adjustment constantly opens up and leaves open. central coordinators often, just to get a grasp of their problem, have to throw information and lines of investigation away. They just can't go down that path because they'll never reach a decision. Whereas in mutual adjustment, there are possibilities open at thousands of points in the system for new information or new analysis to be fed into the system.
Still another top management challenge, part of staying competitive in global markets, is tapping the creativity of people throughout the organization.
There are, in mutual adjustment systems, small ones even, dozens of people, and in large systems, millions of people, who are in a position to change the system, or to introduce something significantly new and that will influence other participants in it. In a central coordinating system, these people are troublesome. They have to be looked upon as spoilers and subversives, often.
Along the lines of getting the right information to make decisions, many executives complain about layers of filtering and interpretation that goes on as information flows from its source to its top executives. We hear many executives, as a result, talking about the need for reality checking. This is evidence of the distortion that goes on in that transmission line.
Another related problem in central coordination is that the central coordinators are enormously dependent on information from down below, and the people down below have, been, as you I think all know, have powerful incentives to lie to the people up above, to misrepresent their needs, for example, for more inputs, to misrepresent the difficulty of carrying out the instructions they're getting from above. It's been a deep and chronic problem in the Soviet Union, over and over again reported by Soviet leadership itself, the difficulty of dealing with these people down below who, fearful that they will fail to reach their targeted production, invest heavily in misrepresenting what they can do and how many resources they need to do it.
One concern we may have in applying the thought of a marketplace to an organization involves the ownership of capital. Does an internal market economy imply that all of the employees own the company and keep their profits?
The market systems can be operated under different forms of property law or with different property institutions. Now, that's a very academic way of saying don't fall into the error of believing that the turn to market systems is necessarily a turn toward private enterprise and what we call capitalism. Some of the people who are rejoicing in the turn toward the market system are rejoicing for the wrong reasons. They're saying what's coming to Eastern Europe is capitalism. Well, it quite possibly is, but we can't be too sure. And if we're looking at the Soviet Union, it's most unlikely that the market reforms there are going to lead to a dominant role for private property and private enterprise. Now, some people think that somehow markets mean private enterprise, but you all know better. You know that there are such things as market-oriented public enterprises. For example, a nationally owned railroad system, run by the government, owned by the government, but whose targets of performance are not set by central direction, but whose targets of performance are set by market demand. In other words, the organization is instructed not to use administratively assigned inputs to produce administratively assigned output targets, as in the Soviet Union, but to buy whatever is necessary on whatever markets offer the inputs that needed, and sell whatever services they can sell. There are municipal water systems like that, or there are nationally owned tobacco companies in many of the countries of Western Europe. Nationally owned railroads should be enough to assure you that it's conceivable that you could have an economy deeply committed to the use of the market system, but at the same time deeply committed to the use of public instead of private enterprise. And this is a real possibility for development in, say, China and the USSR. It's hard to tell which way they're going to go, but it's not at all clear that they're going toward what we call private enterprise and capitalism.
Another potential objection to applying market economies internally arises over the concept of monopolies. We don't want competition through duplication of functions within an organization. Now, most staff functions do have external competitors, but can we have a market economy when an organization has so many natural monopolies?
You may say, but if you don't have competition among private enterprises, how are you going to keep these firms from becoming monopolies and simply exploiting the consumers? Well, there are two answers to that. One is, you can set up publicly run enterprises to compete with each other in the same way that private enterprises compete with each other. No problem in that case. Or, if for some reason or other you don't want competition, for reasons that in some industries we don't want competition in private enterprise systems, you create public utility-like situations. That is to say, for a railroad which is offering services in an area where it can't effectively compete with other railroads or trucks or airlines, you have authorities that supervise their prices to prevent them from just running ahead as monopolistic exploiters of a market, which is the intention of public utility regulation, other price control regulation, even in a private enterprise kind. So there's no problem there at all. Clearly, public enterprises can be the foundation for a market system just as much as private enterprise. So watch to see whether it's capitalism or what we call market socialism that is developing. An early experiment along this line, as you know, is Yugoslavia, which moved from central planning many years ago over to a market, but did not move to capitalism. They moved to what they call socially owned enterprises, a form of worker control rather than traditional corporate and private enterprise and property law. And that tips us off, you see, to the fact that the market system has a greater flexibility than we might have thought, that it might be adapted to a variety of circumstances larger than we have thought, given our tradition that associates in our minds incorrectly market system and private enterprise.
Another question about applying market economics inside a firm is, how do we exercise control over strategic direction? Will top management be able to effectively guide an internal market economy towards shared goals and objectives?
A market system, and this takes a little more explaining, but it's a most interesting point. A market system can be used either as an instrument for making production respond to individual preferences, as expressed on the market, or a system for making production respond to central decisions about where production should go.
Most companies have centrally planned economies. Top executives decide how many information systems, for example, should be produced when they allocate the budgets. Centrally planned economies might decide to produce a certain number of military tanks and then direct the factories to do so.
Of equipping the army with tanks, we can order corporations to produce so many tanks and assign them the inputs necessary to produce those tanks. And we never do it that way. We order the tanks. We buy them. That is, the government buys them and tells the tank manufacturers, you go out and get whatever inputs you need. And to pay for the inputs you need, you get it out of the price that you're negotiating with us that we're paying you for the tanks. So we know already that the market system has been chosen in the United States ordinarily for such central direction as we want for the military or a few other selected purposes.
There is an alternative to management dictums from the top down. That is, the organization can still be guided to pursue a common strategy without such heavy-handed control over who does how much of what. Ed explains.
Just to make the possibility stark and clear, let me give the extreme case of it, where all production is governed by central purchases, all of it. You might say, in that case, why not just issue instructions? And if you stop and think of it, you'll see there are some real advantages in doing it through purchases rather than commands. In that, if you do it through purchases and instruct the responding agencies to get their inputs on the market by spending the money that you're giving them through your purchase, you have freed the central planners from the harrowing and overly detailed tasks of input assignments. They don't have to deal with that at all. That's all decentralized, drastically, furiously decentralized down to the level of the individual producing unit. You've achieved a monumental simplification of the tasks of central direction of the economy.
Ed Lindblom continues to explain the notion of central control of strategic direction through purchasing in a market economy rather than through control in a bureaucracy.
But something else they've got too. When you're directing people to produce this and produce that, you are always dealing with inadequate knowledge because you don't know what it's really costing the economy to respond to your orders. I mean by the real cost of the economy, you don't really know in your commanding position whether when you say produce more trucks, that is going to mean, that has to mean the reduction of some other line of production because you've got finite, limited resources. You can't increase production of A without increasing production somewhere else. When you issue orders like that, you don't really know where the economy is going to slow up its production to accommodate, provide the new resources. Or if you try to plan that, then you're in a position of saying, well, let's have some more trucks and let's put up with fewer airplanes in order to get those more trucks. But what you don't know in the central planning system of the kind the Soviets have had, they don't really know and don't have good information about the real resource drain is required to produce the trucks or the real resource drain required to produce the airplanes. So they're dealing in ignorance with a choice. Whereas if you are buying these inputs, you require always that a price be stated, and that price in a market system is at least a rough reflection of the value of the resources used up, so that you have a constant bulletin board reflecting what your real alternatives are, what your values given up are to get something new, and that is constantly being updated in the form of constant price revision.
What could be more fundamental to empowered entrepreneurs within an organization than a clear understanding of the financial implications upstream and downstream of the decisions they make? Note that Ed has stressed the need for very careful design of economies to fit the needs of an organization. He's presented a variety of alternatives in economic design. He summarizes them here.
How to put those two points together, these last two points. What I'm saying is instead of market systems being, as we have tended to fall into the habit of believing, a system for implementing through private enterprise responses of the productive apparatus to individual demands, we now see that the market system has a potential for being used either under private property or not, and either for individual wants or collective wants or both. You've got four possibilities there and the permutations and combinations. That I find interesting, not because each of those two points, each of those two sets of alternatives are interesting, because taken together, it suggests that the market system is a tool, an instrument, multi-purpose, that can be designed, chosen to do this job or this job. It is not, as our ideology has told us, a kind of well-worn tool for doing only one job of satisfying individual desires through the auspices of private property.
Next, Ed turns his attention to democracy. I see democracy as analogous to the organizational concept of empowerment.
In the history of the world, no democratic nation state has ever arisen except on the basis of a market system. You may not realize what a striking proposition that is. If you look for a democracy in the world, you're going to find a market system. No exceptions. No exceptions. There aren't many rigid associations like that that social science ever find. They love it when they find one. I dearly love this one because it's about the only one I know. If you find a democracy, you find a market system. Now, it doesn't work the other way around. If you find a market system, you haven't necessarily found a democracy. Just look at the systems of the world that are undemocratic market systems. But that association, if a democracy, then a market system, is very striking.
No democracy has emerged without a market system. From that, I conclude that if we truly want to empower our people to better serve our customers, we must remove systemic barriers by moving toward an internal market economy. Ed himself noted the applicability of these concepts within organizations.
Now, when the corporation gets to be a vast, organization operating in various countries of the world, it gets to a point where even with the advantages of new technologies of information and analysis, it's beginning to flounder in the complexity of its own decision-making tasks, then that opens up the possibility of producing within the organization mutual adjustment to replace, to some degree, central decision-making within the corporation, creating internal markets within the firm so that parts of the organization enter into purchases and sales with each other rather than being coordinated simply through central corporate direction. And that also moves to your further point. These comments suggest that even in the most highly developed market systems, there will continue to be, presumably, a need for central planning. By that I mean governmental central planning. That doesn't mean Soviet style. It means touching the economy with the hand of the centralist selectively and strategically here and there where it can make the market system work better. And making market systems work better is a constant challenge to market systems. We have in the United States, you know, allowed our markets to be badly bungled or misshapen, reduced in efficiency by monopoly elements, by all kinds of interventions, failures to circulate information even adequate for decentralized decision-making in the market. And because we have thought ideologically about markets, we haven't been able to debate how to restructure and improve the organization of markets as dispassionately as possible. So that not only do you need at least touches and maybe very heavy components of central planning to guide the market here and there, shape it, keep some things out of the market, but you also need it constantly to attend to the question, can we make the market organization itself better?
Ed was, in his own way, describing the systematic executive, one who programs the organization for success. Not a cog in the machine, but the designer of the machine. Consider Ed's comments here.
All these systems can go wrong. They always do. And the question of the problem of good social organization, or specifically economic organization, is not to avoid error, but to try to minimize the error or create systems which produce correctable errors. That's the strategy we ought to be taking in choosing how to use markets or how to use elements of central planning. I might just repeat that. Never try to design things to get you on target exactly. Always try to design institutions that can cope with your inevitable errors. Hence, keep things open and give you a chance to try again. And that's, of course, one of the great virtues of markets, that they do keep issues open and give you lots of chances to try again, whereas centralists often close off the possibility of trying again.
A healthy organization not only makes the right kinds of decisions automatically, but it's self-correcting. It adjusts to changes in its environment. Executives then can focus their attention on setting strategic direction and fine-tuning the machine. Dr. Ed Lindblom, his lecture to the International Executive Forum of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute. This tape is copyrighted in 1990 by Endine Meyer & Associates, Inc. in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Portions of the Ed Lindblom lecture were used with the permission of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute and Dr. Lindblom. Reproduction of the content of this tape, in any medium, in whole or in part, is expressly forbidden. Thank you.